Welcome to Just for the Health of It, where we bring you new perspectives on the science of health for all. We will bring you local, state, national, and global health news. Here at Just for the Health of It, we bring you the best of both social justice and personal health. At Just for the Health of It, we focus on putting the just in Just for the Health of It. Our aim is to equip you to live healthily in a healthy community on a just planet. I am your host, Dan Rutt. I have a BS degree in biology and a master's degree in public health, specializing in nutrition. I have worked as a health educator, nutrition counselor, community health planner, and AIDS program director, not to mention dishwasher and busboy. I am a former president of the Ohio Public Health Association. This gig is one of several of my non-paying vocations, including lifelong social justice activist, political satirist, and poet. I am a longtime resident of the Old West End neighborhood in Toledo. Welcome to Just for the Health of It. Here we are, episode number 218. It's Monday, July 3rd. I am recording this from an undisclosed location that looks eerily like my den. Well, folks, big public health news these days seems to be air quality, and specifically wildfire smoke coming over particularly the eastern half of the U.S. So first up, we have a story from CBS News, another way that air quality can affect our health. Can air quality affect skin health? A dermatologist explains as more Canadian wildfire smoke hits the U.S. As Canadian wildfire smoke continues to blanket parts of the U.S. and endanger the health of millions of people, experts say there is an organ that requires just as much attention as your lungs, your skin. Pollution can damage the skin a lot by the same mechanisms that UV radiation can, said Dr. Cheyenne Sheriglow, a resident dermatology physician in New York. That's by generating reactive oxygen species that can cause premature aging of the skin and can exacerbate underlying skin conditions like eczema or other inflammatory skin conditions. Reactive oxygen species, according to the National Cancer Institute, are a type of unstable molecule that can damage DNA. Recent studies cited by the American Academy of Dermatology found wildfire smoke is associated with an increase in patient visits for skin conditions, including eczema and psoriasis. Your skin is one of the first lines of defense against the environment, Sheriglow said. Who is most at risk for skin issues stemming from poor air quality? Experts say those with compromised skin barriers should be especially vigilant, such as older people and eczema patients. What can you do to protect your skin from smoke? Creating a barrier between your skin and the unhealthy air is essential. When the pollution is there, it's even more important to consider that you have a strong barrier protection, and that means moisturizing your skin regularly. Of course, you can't forget your sunscreen. Just because it's cloudy or because there's pollution doesn't mean the sun's UV rays can't penetrate down and reach you. Besides moisturizing and putting on sunscreen, staying inside is another good option. If you don't need to go outside, if you do have one of these conditions that does compromise your skin barrier, it may be better to avoid doing so when pollution levels are high. And I would note that also smoking, which is the largest source of indoor air pollution, is also a major cause of premature aging and skin damage. And next up, a story on vaping and smoking. This from Medical Express. Vaping, a gateway to smoking for non-smokers, research shows. While vaping provides a pathway to help smokers wanting to quit, for non-smokers it may be the first step on a pathway to taking up smoking, a new study has shown. Vaping was initially hailed as a new tool to help people quit smoking, but to date, that evidence has been inconsistent. Unlike other studies, the researchers found no consistent evidence that vaping acts as a cessation pathway from smoking. Instead, there are frequent transitions between smoking and vaping, and vice versa. While most individuals continue to engage in the behavior they reported at the previous point in time, there are individuals transitioning between both smoking and vaping. The result offers critical insight into the potential adverse effects of vaping and emphasize the need for stricter policies. Contrary to the hope, vaping appears to have emerged as just another smoking-related behavior, rather than a substitute for smoking that primarily helps people quit. Although the prevalence of smoking decreased over time, the lack of evidence for a cessation effect through vaping suggests the drop may be due to other factors, such as marketing campaigns focused on the negative health impacts and increased costs of buying cigarettes. Furthermore, and perhaps more concerningly, vaping appeared to be equally as likely to increase the uptake of cigarette smoking as it was to have a cessation effect. And for those of you who are trying to quit smoking or vaping yourself or somebody you know and love, you can call the Ohio Quit Line at 1-800-QUIT-NOW. That's 1-800-QUIT-NOW for help to quit smoking or vaping. Okay, next up, I have a story on infectious disease, specifically hepatitis C. This from MedPage Today. Jarringly low hep C cure rates a decade after new treatment, CDC says. Only 1 in 3 U.S. adults infected with hepatitis C virus have been cured since direct-acting antivirals became available 10 years ago, CDC data showed. Among 1 million adults with evidence of initial infection using 2013 to 2022 national hepatitis C testing data, only 34% had viral clearance of their infection, despite a national goal of over 80% achieving clearance by 2030, reported Carolyn Wester of the CDC's National Center for HIV, Viral Hepatitis, STD, and TB Prevention. Moreover, only 16% of people under the age of 40 without health insurance were cured, they noted in the Morbidity and Mortality Weekly report. We found jarringly low cure levels across the board, Wester said during a press briefing. Lack of diagnosis and treatment costs are both to blame, in addition to restrictive treatment coverage policies by payers, the researchers said. Over 2 million people in the U.S. have hepatitis C infection, according to estimates from the CDC. About 1 million of these people are not aware and have mild symptoms, but infection can lead to liver damage and can cause liver cancer, liver failure, and death. Hepatitis C is spread through contact with blood from an infected person, often by sharing needles or other equipment used to prepare and inject drugs. Hepatitis C is a silent killer, Wester said. While this study looked at treatment gaps among people with diagnosed hepatitis C, there's also a great need for increased screening and testing. Everyone with hepatitis C deserves a chance to be cured. The Viral Hepatitis National Strategic Plan calls for over 80% of people with hepatitis C to achieve viral clearance by 2030. Rapid tests are a big part of achieving this goal, researchers said. In Europe and Australia, rapid tests are already available. Initiating this program would save the federal government more than $13 billion just in the first 10 years and $44 billion in 20 years, adding that cost savings would come from a reduction in liver transplants and liver cancer treatment. It's rare to have both an opportunity to save lives and save money, but that's what we have here. You can't know this and just walk away. So there you have it, folks. Prevention and early treatment is worth a pound of healthcare. And of course, having a treatment doesn't necessarily mean that treatment will get to the people who need it, particularly in the American healthcare system.
And now for a word from our lack of sponsors. PR Medica and Merciless Health are rated in the top 100 in clinical excellence in some category that hopefully covers the healthcare you might be able to access. Warning, such excellence may be severely limited by being delivered in the least effective and most expensive sick care system among the so-called advanced economies. While you may be privileged enough or lucky enough to get access to excellent care, your community overall is poorly served. Any such clinical excellence is best taken with a double dose of advocacy for universal health care. This program is not sponsored by PR Medica or Merciless Health. PR Medica and Merciless Health are unwholly owned subsidiaries of Tourette's Industries, ensuring that you will swear by them, whether you like it or not. And now, back to your irregular programming.
Okay, well, next up, I have a story that also gets at a health problem that often goes undetected and untreated. This from Medical Express. Nearly half of tuberculosis cases in prisons worldwide go undetected. In the first global assessment of TB, or tuberculosis among incarcerated people, a new study found consistently high TB case rates and low case detection in prisons, suggesting the need for health organizations to create efforts to reduce the spread of TB among this high-risk population. In 2019, incarcerated people across the globe developed TB at nearly 10 times the rate of people in the general population, according to a new study led by Boston University School of Public Health. Despite this high case rate, nearly half of TB cases among incarcerated people were not even detected. Mass incarceration is one major driver of TB transmission, both inside and outside of prisons. Overcrowding, where some prison cells contain up to 30 people, causes TB to spread like wildfire, and this transmission can spill over easily into the community. Contrary to popular belief, persons that are incarcerated are a mobile population, and in many countries, the duration of incarceration is very short. People go into prison, then come out, and then may go back in again. So very often, people that develop tuberculosis in prison end up transmitting the disease to many people outside of prison once they are released. Since almost half the people with tuberculosis in prisons are not diagnosed, many still remain infectious when they enter back into the general community. The team hopes that these findings will encourage global and regional health organizations to develop routine monitoring of TB among incarcerated people, as they do for other high-risk populations, such as people with HIV and household contacts of people with TB. And yet another example of the interface between vulnerable populations that often aren't as valued as much actually have a large impact on the overall community as well. We need to take care of the least of these to take care of all of us as well. Okay, well, there's definitely one health issue that's growing in the consciousness of Americans. This from the Washington Post. More Americans see gun violence as a major problem, poll finds. A growing number of Americans, including Democrats and Republicans, now view gun violence as a significant problem, and a majority expect it to get worse over the next 5 years, according to a new poll released from the Pew Research Center. While the poll found that twice as many Democrats as Republicans said gun violence is a very big problem in the nation, at 81% of Democrats compared with 38% of Republicans, Pew noted that over the last year, the number of people in both parties who said gun violence is a very big problem has increased 11%. The poll found that 62% of Americans said that the level of gun violence will increase over the next 5 years, twice as many as those who said it will stay around the same level. Pew also found that since 2022, the share of Americans who said violent crime is a major problem has slightly increased from 60 to 64% among Republicans and 47% to 52% among Democrats. Still, members of both parties remain split over the issue of gun ownership. The poll found that 79% of Republicans and independents who lean Republican said gun ownership increases safety, while 78% of Democrats and independents who lean Democratic said it decreases safety. I would add that public health research decidedly shows that increased gun ownership actually decreases safety. More guns is not the solution to gun safety. According to Pew, the share of Americans who said gun laws should be stricter have shifted only slightly, from 53% in 2021 to 58% today. While a majority of women at 64% said gun laws should be strengthened, just 51% of men said the same. Notably, 77% of Black Americans said gun laws should be stricter, along with 74% of Asian Americans and 68% of Hispanic Americans. Among white Americans, 51% said the same. Research released in April from Kaiser Family Foundation found that 42% of Black Americans had personally experienced being threatened by a gun, seeing someone injured with a gun, or having a family member killed by a gun, which includes suicide. Nearly 6 in 10 Black Americans said a family member has experienced one of these things. For Hispanic Americans, the figure is 54%. Less than half of white Americans said a family member has come that close to gun violence, and about a quarter of white Americans said they personally experience such threats or violence. Okay, well, next up, a topic that seems to be receding in the American mind, COVID. This from The Hill. More in new polls say pandemic is over, but fewer than half say lives are back to normal. More Americans in a new Gallup poll say they believe the COVID-19 pandemic is over, though fewer than half of those surveyed say their lives are back to normal. The survey published last Wednesday found that 64% of respondents said the COVID-19 pandemic is over, while 36% think otherwise. When asked whether their lives will ever get completely back to, quote, normal that existed before the pandemic, 43% of all respondents said their normal lives have resumed, while 41% said they do not expect their lives to ever go back to pre-pandemic normalcy. 15% said their lives are not yet back to pre-pandemic normalcy, but eventually they will be. So that's interesting. Of the 41% that don't expect their lives to go back to pre-pandemic normalcy, you can subtract out 15%, and that brings you 26% that think we'll eventually be back to a pre-pandemic normal. I guess I'm part of that 25% that thinks that the COVID-19 pandemic has forever changed what normal is, in both good and bad ways. But normal ain't the same as it was pre-pandemic. Well, in honor of the COVID-19 pandemic, we have this. The following message contains just enough truth to scare just enough people to scare just about everyone. Dihydrogen monoxide exposure is rampant across the globe. Dihydrogen monoxide is found at high concentrations wherever life is found. You cannot escape it. Did you know that more people have died after recent exposure to dihydrogen monoxide than have died from any of the leading causes of death? What kind of conspiracy is this that so-called experts dismiss so casually? What you will never hear is that virtually every public health expert will concede privately that exposure to dihydrogen monoxide in the days before death is commonplace. However, publicly, virtually every public health expert will deny that exposure to dihydrogen monoxide is a leading cause of death. While dihydrogen monoxide is literally raining down on us, their silence is thunderous. Don't let broad scientific consensus water down these alarming facts. Our fear is real, and our privilege. Tell your friends about the dihydrogen monoxide conspiracy before it's too late. This dire warning has been brought to you by the H2 Oh My God Confederacy, where we explain everything as there is nothing to it. Here at the H2 Oh My God Confederacy, we know in our gut that without dihydrogen monoxide, drinking the Kool-Aid would be impossible. Okay, well, next up, I want to do a little historical or retrospective here and go back 35 years ago within a story that'll give us an example of how, even amidst strong ideological lines, sometimes you can be surprised, and that can even benefit public health. This from the Washington Post. An AIDS epidemic pamphlet defied Ronald Reagan and taught America sex ed. 35 years ago, Americans opened their mailboxes during the HIV/AIDS epidemic to discover a sealed package from the U.S. government. The mass mailing came whether they wanted it or not, and it came with a warning, quote, "Some of the issues involved in this brochure may not be things you are used to discussing openly." The 1988 mailer, which came from the U.S. Public Health Service, marked a bold step in sex education, launching a public discussion about HIV/AIDS that was grounded in science and influenced public health efforts on diseases from COVID-19 to Mpox. It also caused a firestorm, embroiling the man behind the effort, Surgeon General C. Everett Koop, a charismatic evangelical whom President Reagan had nominated 6 years earlier, thinking Koop's faith meant he would never do anything of the sort. "He was a guy who surprised everybody," said Tony Fauci, the retired director of the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Disease, who worked with Koop on AIDS matters. At the time of the appointment, Reagan and his administration believed they had found the perfect nominee. Koop, a pediatrician, had no background in public health. He was fiercely opposed to abortion and, quote, "strongly approved of homosexuality." As he later wrote in his autobiography, Koop, the Memoirs of America's Family Doctor, and he frequently cites the ways his Christian belief shaped his medical practice. His nomination had been incredibly contentious, sparking protests on the left, in the public health community, and among organizations such as Planned Parenthood. But his appointment had cemented the Reagan administration's commitment to the Christian right. The administration and its allies were confident that Koop would be an evangelical Christian first and a public health advocate second. Much to the administration's shock, the opposite turned out to be true. During his tenure, Koop used his position as a bully pulpit, making a special point of wearing my uniform, he wrote. He appeared on talk shows, at high schools, and at churches to share his views on everything from smoking to nutrition. As Time magazine put it, Surgeon General C. Everett Koop has an opinion, which he will give you with great certainty at high speed. He did not, however, share his views on the emergence of a new disease, HIV/AIDS. While Cooper disapproved of homosexual acts, he believed as a physician and a Christian that his work entailed protecting the public's health. And he came to believe, too, that conservatives in the Reagan administration attempted to thwart my attempts to educate the public about AIDS, he wrote. In 1986, Cooper reached a breaking point. He turned to one of the primary tools at his disposal, the creation of a new Surgeon General's report. Beginning in 1964, when Surgeon General Luther Terry had released a groundbreaking report on the dangers of smoking, these reports had highlighted public health concerns. Now Coop, with the assistance of a few public health officials, wrote a detailed and explicit report about HIV and how Americans could and should protect themselves. The federal government had been creating sex education materials since 1918, pamphlets that typically had taken one of two approaches. Those intended for the general public relied heavily on euphemisms and vague language. Those intended for the military used slang terms, warning to avoid, quote, whores, or for fear of contracting, quote, the clap. By contrast, Coop used specific and highly clinical terms in his report, referencing oral, anal, and vaginal intercourse. He believed neutral language would prevent readers from allowing their moral or religious beliefs to cloud their judgment of a medical issue. You cannot get AIDS from casual social contact, such as shaking hands, hugging, social kissing, crying, coughing, or sneezing, the report stated. It also cannot be transmitted via toilets, doorknobs, telephones, office machinery, or household furniture. But the report went even further, explaining that you cannot get AIDS from body massagers, masturbation, or any non-sexual contact. Reagan administration officials were incensed by the explicit language. William Bennett, the Secretary of Education, seed that the report's emphasis on the use of condoms might be, quote, clinically correct, but it was morally bankrupt. Reagan's Health and Human Services officials created their own campaign in 1987. Using the slogan America Responds to AIDS, the new campaign provided little guidance about how Americans could protect themselves against the new disease. It did, however, promote abstinence. Frustrated by the administration's approach, legislators in Congress turned to Coop. They asked for information about AIDS to be distributed directly to every American, regardless of where they lived or who they were, and appropriated $20 million for the effort to be cleared by health leaders, not the White House. The 7-page Understanding AIDS mailer, a highly condensed version of Coop's 1986 report, was the result, made available in English and Spanish. The logistics in preparing the mailer were laborious. Just printing it took 2,900 miles of paper. The Public Health Service requisitioned railroad cars to store the 114 million copies of the mailer before its release. Understanding AIDS spoke to recipients unwaveringly. It stated that condoms have been shown to help prevent the spread of sexually transmitted diseases and recommended their use. The White House doesn't like the C word, Coop told the Time reporter, but if you don't talk about condoms, people are going to die. In the wake of its arrival in Americans' mailboxes, political and religious leaders on the right took to the airwaves to denounce it. The evangelical preacher Jerry Falwell said Coop should have simply said, no sex outside of marriage, and save taxpayers' money. Judy Brown, the head of the American Life League, a Catholic organization that opposed abortion and contraception, said, disinformation abounds in the brochure. The report, she alleged, quote, caters to such lifestyles as homosexuality and bisexuality by avoiding even a modest encouragement toward a type of sexual relationship designed by nature for man and woman to become one in marriage. Cartoonists had a field day, depicting parents warning children against opening anything from the Surgeon General. Boston Globe cartoonist Dan Wasserman drew Reagan lamenting to an aide the release of Coop's, quote, filthy little book. Reagan himself did not speak publicly about the mailer. The media storm, ironically, ensured that the pamphlet became a major news story. Follow-up surveys indicated that more than 80% of Americans read the mailer. Call centers had been set up to answer questions, were overwhelmed by callers eager to learn more. Understanding AIDS would mostly be forgotten in the years that followed, but it marked a turning point in AIDS education and in public health. You saw a Surgeon General, Coop's successor Richard Carmona said in 2009, change the way our nation and the world dealt with an infectious disease. Change happens, my friends, even from strange places. You are listening to Just for the Health of It on WAKT 106.1 FM Toledo, We Act Radio. This is the People's School of Public Health in the University of Life. Okay, well, next up, I want to follow up with another historical retrospective, but this one has even a more direct connection to what's happening today in public health. This from The Guardian. Chemical industry used big tobacco's tactics to conceal evidence of PFAS risks. That's those forever chemicals. DuPont, or 3M scientists, discovered PFAS toxicity internally, but did not publish findings or report them to the EPA, study says. In 1953, a paper developed for cigarette makers R.J. Reynolds detailed possible cancer-causing agents in tobacco, but the document would remain hidden from public view for decades. In the interim, the industry told the public, "We don't accept the idea that there are harmful agents in tobacco." The chemical industry, it seemed, took note. Just a few years later, DuPont scientists found PFAS in large lab rats' livers and likely caused birth defects in workers. Still, the company told its employees and cancer-linked compounds are, quote, about as toxic as table salt. By the way, table salt's actually fairly toxic. Sodium is a major killer, causes high blood pressure and cardiovascular disease. But, of course, most people don't put that at the top of their list of toxicity. Like the tobacco industry before it, the chemical industry managed to keep PFAS's health risks hidden from the public for decades. A new peer-reviewed study dissecting PFAS's producers' public relations strategies provides a smoking gun timeline composed of industry studies and comments from DuPont and 3M officials showing they knew the dangers but publicly insisted the chemicals were safe. The chemical industry used the tactics of the tobacco industry to delay public awareness of the toxicity of PFAS and, in turn, delayed regulations governing their use, the University of California at San Francisco authors wrote. PFAS are now ubiquitous in the population and environment. PFAS are a class of about 15,000 chemicals, often used to make thousands of products resistant to water, stains, and heat. The compounds are linked at low levels of exposure to cancer, thyroid disease, kidney dysfunction, birth defects, autoimmune disease, and other serious health problems. They are called forever chemicals because of the longevity in the environment and your body. The public largely would not learn of the health threat until subpoenaed records in the lawsuit against DuPont revealed the chemicals' toxicity and industry cover-up. The study used scientific methodology previously developed by tobacco industry researcher Stan Glanz to analyze similar documents from cigarette makers. The authors found PFAS producers and their allies most frequently employed two tobacco strategies: withholding internal studies that revealed health risks, and distorting public discourse. All of these companies try to prevent the development of public understanding, and they're always years ahead of the public and mainstream scientific community, Glantz said. Between 1961 and 2006, the authors identified dozens of instances where DuPont or 3M scientists discovered or acknowledged PFAS toxicity internally, but did not publish the findings or report them to the EPA as required under federal law. DuPont's chief toxicologist in 1961 found rats' livers enlarged at very low doses of exposure, a health impact recognized as, quote, the most sensitive sign of toxicity. The report recommended PFAS be handled, quote, with extreme care, and that, quote, contact with the skin should be strictly avoided. By the way, PFAS is also present in clothing. Yikes. Around the same time, a DuPont worker died from PFAS inhalation, which the company on multiple occasions dismissed as a rumor. Meanwhile, workers reported an epidemic of flu-like symptoms from Teflon exposure. In 1970, a DuPont-funded lab found PFAS to be highly toxic when inhaled and moderately toxic when ingested. About a decade later, the lab killed two dogs with low doses of the chemicals. The lab also observed corneal ulcerations in newborns. And 3M, in a report shared with DuPont, quote, observed fetus eye changes that were due to PFAS. In the early 1980s, DuPont found elevated liver enzymes in 60% of workers tested, and a confidential internal report detailed birth defects among pregnant plant employees. In the years that followed, 3M and DuPont internal studies found the chemicals likely caused prostate, testicular, bladder, and kidney cancers. Virtually none of this information was shared with the public, regulators, or DuPont employees, and none of the research was published in a scientific journal. The motivation, said study co-author Tracy Woodruff, was profits. Surprise, surprise. This is a chemical that made them a lot of money, and these studies that showed the chemicals are harmful would be threatening their profits if the studies came out, she added. Instead, in a 1980 memo circulated to employees, DuPont insisted, quote, there is no known evidence that our employees have been exposed to PFAS levels that pose adverse health effects, end of quote. We know of no evidence of birth defects caused by PFAS at DuPont, the document continued, adding that the chemicals are, quote, about as toxic as table salt. When water pollution near its Parkersburg, West Virginia plant seemed to be sickening residents, DuPont responded in a press release that DuPont and 3M have found, quote, no known toxic or ill health effects in humans at concentration levels detected. As media and public scrutiny of the chemicals' dangers increased in the 2000s, DuPont Vice President Susan Stalnecker wrote an email to the EPA in 2006 with the subject line, urgent EPA action needed. Quote, we need the EPA to act quickly, like first thing tomorrow. Say the following. 1, that consumer products sold under the Teflon brand are safe. And 2, further to date, there are no human health effects known to be caused by PFOA, which is one of the PFASs, the email read. That same year, 3M funded a study that found no liver effects in men exposed to PFAS. PFAS manufacturers have continued to conceal evidence since inclusion of the DuPont lawsuit. The Guardian in 2021 revealed how DuPont and Japanese chemical maker Daikin hid evidence of the toxicity of 6,2-FTOH, a new generation of allegedly safe PFAS compounds that was approved for use in food packaging in 2009. But the company's testing before and after approval showed the chemicals caused kidney failure, liver damage, mammary gland problems, mottled teeth, and other issues in lab rats. It's unclear how the industry hides today, but their history makes me think that there's always something that they aren't disclosing, said Maricel Maffini, an independent consultant who blew the whistle on 6,2-FTOH. She said the problem is in part due to the nation's weak regulatory system, which in the case of the Food and Drug Administration does not require chemical companies to alert the agency if it finds a chemical is more dangerous than was known at the time it was approved. Governments have begun taking only the most basic steps to protect the public from PFAS, and the federal government has yet to set any enforceable rules. The most meaningful legislation has come at the state level over the last 2 years, where a crop of laws now prohibit PFAS in consumer goods such as clothing, food packaging, firefighting foam, and cosmetics. The delay was a direct result of the PFAS industry's campaign, Woodruff said. Had the internal documents been released sooner, the EPA may have acted differently, and independent scientists would have been studying the chemicals. That would have generated the kind of public pressure that is only now forcing governments to respond. Yes, my friend, a tale as old as time. Profits over public health.
And now, a message from our lack of sponsors. Do you suffer from moderate to severe disenchantment from rampant capitalism running the lives of you and your loved ones? From daily sexism that can't be mansplained away? From endemic racism that nobody seems to see? Try Eliminol. It's the blue pill from Placebo Pharmaceutical Corporation. It's everything you think it is. The blue pill is a choice you'll never need to feel bad about ever again. Warning, use of Eliminol may lead to addiction in conjunction with a profound sense of not caring that you are addicted. Or caring for much of anything else at all, for that matter. If you have any residual concerns, call our lifelong customer hotline, 1-800-CALLUS. Call us whenever, callous always. We now return you to your regular programming, bringing you non-commercial radio, featuring locally produced content and fresh perspectives from non-corporate persons. Good luck with that.
Okay, well that brings us to our last feature, bonus articles. A carefully curated combination of headlines you can use and long reads for increased enrichment. Available online, just like all the stories I've reported on in this episode. You can read these by going to toppun.com/blog/WAKT. I'll give the link again at the end of the list, and it's a rather long list today. We have 30 bonus articles this week. First up, going back to the origins of this show. Over 4 years ago, the very first show I did was on democracy and public health. And this article is Threats to Democracy Are Threats to Health. So there's a lot of ways that this is mediated, But basically, minority rule, the will of the people being thwarted. And it looks, you know, the people actually care about their health. Widespread support for people's own health and the public health. But threats to democracy trickle down or trickle up, however you want to call it, to make public health more difficult to actually achieve. Bonus article 2, harassment against scientists is out of control. So this is my epidemiologist post in Substack, and is another example of one of the ways that our democracy is being threatened by using bullying and violence rather than democratic free exchange of ideas and science, and particularly targeting scientists, which are more subject to harassment than non-scientists. And somewhat related, bonus article 3, misinformation obscures standards guiding gender-affirming care for trans youth. So this has been a hyper-politicized issue that Republicans have been using as a cudgel. And with all of the misinformation out there, it's really hard to get an accurate view of what exactly the standards are for gender-affirming care. They're actually quite involved and actually pretty good that really protect folks that are seeking gender-affirming care and allow them to get the best possible care that's available. Well, the thing is, you don't get that message from listening to most of the messages around gender-affirming care. It sounds like you just walk into a place and, you know, have surgery or something, and that is definitely not the case. Bonus article 4. Millions face a relentless summer of smoke that won't end anytime soon. So those of us in the eastern half of the country already know that these last couple of weeks we've been hit with a couple days-long batches of smoke from Canadian wildfires. Well, those Canadian wildfires are still raging, and the only reason we're not inundated by it right now is because the wind direction changed. But they're still raging, and when the wind direction changes again, we very well may be in similar circumstances over and over again. And sticking to the climate change theme, bonus article 5, extreme heat is here to stay. Why are we not more afraid? So this is actually a book review of that the heat will kill us first. That's, you know, there's a lot of methods of climate change that affect our environment that can be deadly for us. But actually, just the obvious one of just extreme heat is actually very deadly, particularly to vulnerable populations. But when you're talking about the fact that wide swaths of the entire world could become unlivable by current standards, which could, of course, lead to climate migration. There's a lot of cascading effects. But the extreme heat itself actually is very dangerous, and we don't seem to be that concerned about it. And another climate change story, bonus article 6, Texas heat isn't letting up at night. So this isn't unique to Texas. This is just a story that's centered around the Texas heat wave that's happened here recently. And that's one of the kind of underappreciated problems with rising temperatures with global warming is that while you get higher highs, you know, we talk about record-breaking highs, actually, we're more likely actually to set record-breaking lows at night. I mean, they're hot. The lows are higher, but they're the highest level that the lows have been. Well, that's a little confusing, but hopefully you get the point. So the thing is, this is actually more dangerous of an indicator for actually heat health effects, because when you can't cool down at night, when the cities, you know, take heat during the day and then radiate it at night, and the lows don't get very low, it doesn't allow our bodies to actually catch up and cool down, and it makes the next day's heat all the worse. Okay, bonus article 7, related story. Pressure builds for FEMA to declare deadly heat events as disasters. So this is probably something that needs to happen to just have parity in recognizing the Federal Emergency Management Agency, what actually is an emergency. And heat events are very disastrous and actually kill more people than tornadoes and hurricanes combined. And what this would do is, if FEMA now considered heat events as disasters, that would allow the freeing up of federal resources and streamline certain things that would allow a more quick and robust response. But of course, that's on the back end of disasters, which is needed. But of course, we need a lot of effort to prevent global warming in the first place to mitigate these deadly heat events. Bonus article 8, heat, humidity, and smoke. Oh my. This is another one from my epidemiologist. This is sort of an epidemiological brief or primer. So if you want to just kind of get a good little understanding of how heat, humidity, and smoke affect our health, a great read. Bonus article 9, how safe is your office air? There's one way to find out, which of course is measuring it. So this is a story from the New York Times about a New York City high-rise building that put in air sensors and then, you know, put it, you could just look on a monitor and you could see, you know, what the CO2 and what the particulate matter was and the NO2 and different types of things. And of course that raises the consciousness. And indoor air quality, while it's often linked to outdoor air quality as well, when this office building actually got hit with this smoke, it actually did have a lot of protection, and those sensors showed that. So, of course, the people working in that building can feel a little bit safer. But, of course, it's complicated, but if you don't measure something, it's hard to actually do anything about it. So it is a good first step because, for instance, it's hard to measure like COVID or other infectious diseases directly, but one proxy that they use is the amount of CO2 that we breathe off, because if that accumulates, that means the air is sort of stale and not being circulated and being refreshed like with outside air, so that which would dilute out the viral concentrations and help prevent infectious diseases being spread, respiratory infectious diseases from being spread. So by measuring those things, you can get a clue. And CO2 in and of itself definitely affects like our cognitive ability and learning and that type of thing. Okay. Bonus article 11. Oh, I'm sorry, 10. We're building infrastructure based on climate we no longer live in. So this is really just a lag, since climate's changing fast, that the weather data that's used for building infrastructure, whether it's about heat or wind or the amount of precipitation, the likelihood of, you know, tornadoes or hurricanes, that type of thing, we're using data that's old. And this is particularly important since building infrastructure is a long-term project. You know, it's not about just what you do this year, but what you do this year actually is an infrastructure that we'll be living with for decades and potentially many decades to come with. So we need to up those standards more quickly so that we're actually building infrastructure based on the climate that we are now and the climate that we expect to be in the future. Bonus article 11, a grid collapse would make a heat wave far deadlier. I don't know, but myself personally, in the last few years, I've experienced a lot more power outages than I did in the previous decades I've lived in the same place in Toledo. Now, a total grid collapse or large grid collapse are not that common, but they are becoming more common, like 150% more common than they were like a decade ago or so. But there needs to be more plans both to deal with grid failures and rolling blackouts, as well as just improving the infrastructure so the grid doesn't collapse, particularly since things are changing, like, for instance, electric vehicles. Now you're going to be drawing that power off the electric grid rather than from, say, gasoline. We're actually seeing the demand for electricity go up, whereas it's been relatively stable in recent years. Bonus article 12. The EPA was on the cusp of cleaning up Cancer Alley, then it backed down. So this is a failure, a little cowardice of the Justice Department. They dropped three civil rights cases that were dealing with Louisiana's Cancer Alley, which is just terrible. I've reported on this before. And it's probably just they were afraid to just do what it took to push it through, even though a lot of experts and certainly community activists in those areas most affected are very disappointed, because it seems like the Justice Department could have won those cases, but they backed down based on political pressure. Bonus article 13. The ugly side of beauty. Chemicals in cosmetics threaten college-age women's reproductive health. So these chemicals in cosmetics that threaten college-age women's reproductive health are, a lot of them are endocrine disruptors, which of course affects everybody's health, But young women are kind of the canary in the coal mine, sort of speak. And this is something that we need to pay more attention to. And in a somewhat related article, another environmental hazard article, bonus article 14, how plastics are poisoning us. They both release and attract toxic chemicals and appear everywhere from human placentas to chasms 36,000 feet beneath the sea. Will we ever be rid of them? And by the way, 36,000 feet, that's, you know, if you fly in an airplane, you're like 5, 6 miles, 7 miles up in the air. That's like 6, 7 miles beneath the sea. You can still find plastics everywhere. And that is, I've reported on this before, but that the fact that plastics themselves are dangerous, releasing toxic chemicals that they have in the manufacturing, the composition of the plastic, but also plastics attract toxic chemicals in the environment and carry them with them. So if you're picking up plastics in your body, often you get a little rider of other toxic chemicals that have hitched a ride on plastics, making them even more toxic. Okay, a couple articles, a few articles here about pregnant women. 15, a more good story. Let's get a good story in the middle of all this. The Pregnant Workers Fairness Act is a game changer for U.S. women. Here's why. So a good read. And basically what this is fixing a gap, a crack in the American Disabilities Act that really didn't fit protecting pregnant workers well. Now, there's specific laws around pregnant workers, around reasonable accommodation, around changes that happen during pregnancy, and new vulnerabilities that pregnant women have. And the other next two stories are about postpartum depression, which is a real and not uncommon thing. It's like 40% of women have some postpartum depression. And this is another example of where you've got a very vulnerable population in a very epic stage and transition of life of having a new child, that they're very vulnerable and need special levels of support. And these two are the articles, bonus 16, articles 16 and 17. The first is, I felt like I was dying, how women with postpartum depression fall through the cracks in the U.S. healthcare. And then article 17, life in the throes of postpartum depression. Both of these talk in pretty good detail about postpartum depression's problems and how our U.S. society and U.S. healthcare system doesn't deal with it very well. Another call to action. Well, speaking of vulnerable populations, the next two are about prisoners. Bonus article 19, man down, surviving the Texas heat in prisons without air conditioning. I reported on such things before, but this is really brutal. I mean, prisons are not really known for their human rights conditions. But with air conditioning, particularly Texas, when you have like the heat wave that they've had, which has been a record setting, there's a lot of prisons. I think most prisons in Texas don't actually have air conditioning. So that can be particularly brutal. And prisoners have to think of very elaborate ways to try to cool themselves. But one of the really scary things when you get into very high temperatures, particularly when it's very humid, is that once the temperature of the air gets to your body temperature, just under 100 degrees, if you use a fan, it'll actually heat you up. Particularly if you can get a little bit from the cooling from evaporating sweat, but if you have high humidity, that can be negated. And certainly when you're talking about like 110 degrees inside a prison, there's very little you can do, and it's killing people. And part of the problem is when someone dies in prison due to, heat stroke or whatever, heat-related condition, they're often just, they'll just say it's a heart attack, whatever. They don't really attribute it properly to a heat death. And even worse, bonus article 19, conditions at Guantanamo are cruel and inhuman, UN investigation finds. So it's been many, many years since the U.S. has even let the UN do any kind of study at Guantanamo about the conditions. And the UN finds that basically it's cruel and inhuman, and just the day-to-day living situation is borderline torture. Bonus article 20, sickle cell disease is 11 times more deadly than previously recorded. So this is a World Health Organization study, and it's looking globally. Now, sickle cell disease is something that is overwhelmingly found in black populations, and worldwide is found mostly in sub-Saharan Africa, which is a very poor part of the country. And this article gets at a bunch of kind of facets of public health. First, that because sickle cell disease is not necessarily identified and tracked in kind of the healthcare trajectory of people, when they die of something, you know, like say a stroke, it could actually be sickle cell related, but if you're just put down as dying of a stroke, the underlying cause is sickle cell disease. You know, if somebody dies at age 20 of a stroke, that's not very common, but if you have sickle cell disease, it's not that rare or uncommon. So 11 times more deadly than previously recorded. And sickle cell disease is actually a leading cause of death in younger populations, in youth and young adults. And of course, it also brings up the facet in public health that you have diseases that are in racial ethnic minority groups, and most of the world is driven by white supremacy who are taking care of their own diseases, so to speak, ahead of time. And so it's a neglected disease. And even in this country, not that we're immune to white supremacy at all, but it's way underfunded relative to the amount of death and morbidity that it causes. Bonus article 21. Opioids are overrated for some common back pain. This was a really good study, and just a reminder that opioids, you know, even though we've all seen the results of the opioid epidemic, that the big lie of opioids that they're somehow these the best pain relievers possible actually isn't really true. So actually, many just over-the-counter pain relievers are actually better than opioids. So we have to be very careful with opioids, as they can be overrated in actually dealing with pain, and of course, they can lead to addiction. Bonus article 22, that essential morning coffee may be a placebo. So this is just kind of a good commentary, I guess, on the placebo effect, but it was an interesting study that they actually just like took the caffeine and out of coffee, and then they tested how people alert they felt, and you know that morning perk or whatever that you get from the coffee, and found that actually the decaffeinated and caffeinated were no different. People couldn't tell the difference. They got the perk anyway, so it may very well just be a placebo. It may be that the process that we assign to it of waking up or whatever, but may not necessarily be even the caffeine itself. Bonus article 23: WHO's Cancer Research Agency says aspartame sweetener is a possible carcinogen. So this is a new move, and the WHO came out with something, giving a warning really about artificial sweeteners, and it's just another thing in that lineup that aspartame now is considered a possible carcinogen. We need more research to make that definitive. Myself, I just practice a precautionary principle. If in doubt, stay away from possible carcinogens if you can avoid it. Bonus article 24, as low nicotine cigarettes hit the market, anti-smoking groups press for wider standard. So in about 18 states soon, there's going to be low nicotine cigarettes that are going to be marketed, the FDA approved. And these would be nicotine low enough that it wouldn't be addictive. But it's sort of part of the quest of trying to find a safe cigarette. Not really sure how this is going to work out, but actually probably the best advocate is just trying to get all cigarettes down to a non-addictive level of nicotine. Because currently the FDA has no limits on the amount of nicotine in smoked products. Bonus article 25, Georgia launches Medicaid expansion and closely watched test of work requirements. This is in fact, another kind of disaster of work requirements. We know that it complicates things bureaucratically, is expensive to monitor, and results in a lot of people who even qualify not to end up getting Medicaid. The Georgia plan would at best only address 10 to 20% of the people that a full Medicaid expansion would. And the state is actually going to spend over a third because they have to use the regular Medicaid state contribution rather than the Medicaid expansion, which covers 95% the first 2 years and 90% every year afterwards. So it's more expensive and is like a 10 or 20% solution. Yeah, okay, we can do better. Bonus article 26, Supreme Court strikes down use of affirmative action, a blow to diversify medical schools. So the medical schools in particular have had a problem getting minorities, racial and ethnic minority students over the years, and has not really made much progress over decades. So that is only probably going to get worse. Bonus article 27, George W. Bush's AIDS fighting programs new critics, Republicans, as kind of an example. I kind of like my favorite kind of anti-government quote is that you can always count on government doing the right thing, but only after exhausting every possibility. And this one, basically, the Republicans, even if they accidentally do something right, will eventually figure it out and screw it up. So Republicans are basically linking up the AIDS fighting program that George Bush started. It's getting messed up with the whole abortion politics internationally. Bonus Article 28, malaria has always been a risk, but U.S. outbreaks are rare thanks to surveillance. Kind of a kudo for surveillance. The fact if you pay attention to something and you see it, an outbreak, you can actually deal with it before it becomes a larger problem. Bonus Article 29, states and the CDC to track Chronobacter cases. These are the what triggered the baby formula crisis, these infections that came out of the factories, and treat it like other infectious diseases, which means it's a reportable disease. Hopefully this will be, it's actually pretty rare, but when it does happen, you want to know about it. So if a physician, for instance, finds one of these cases, they need to report it like other infectious diseases, many other infectious diseases. 30, melted, pounded, and extruded. Why many ultra-processed foods are unhealthy. Industrial processing fundamentally changes the structure of food. This is one of the most basic ways that hyper-processed, ultra-processed foods lead to chronic disease and health problems. It's almost like they're pre-digested, and then they don't really resemble food. Often they're, you know, these components are extruded, taken out, and put back together in a way that, you know, you lose a lot of the nutrients. And the basic way that the body processes it, digests it, and absorbs it is fundamentally changed. Okay, well, you can view these and all the articles I've reported on by going to toppun.com/blog/WAKT. That's toppun.com/blog/WAKT. Thank you for spending this hour with me, my second most favorite hour of the week. I'll be signing off now from the John Snow Memorial Studio. John Snow is considered the father of epidemiology, the science of public health. He studied infectious waterborne cholera outbreaks in London and famously persuaded local officials in 1854 to remove a pump handle from the infectious well that he had tracked down as the source. The cholera outbreak ended, and emerging germ theory took a quantum leap forward in battling the then leading causes of death, infectious diseases. May his passion and scientific tenaciousness continue to inspire us all today. Here at WAKT, We Act Radio, passion is an essential ingredient to our life. And while scientific assessment is key to public health success, passion is as much a touchstone to success in living well as anything. So I will close with a quote from the Reverend Dr. Howard Thurman. Don't ask what the world needs. Ask what makes you come alive and go do it, because what the world needs is people who have come alive. And on that note, let's take it home with Emma's Revolution. Check them out. I need some justice.